From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Eric Westervelt. This is On Point. There are at least 17 active fires now in California, from the Oregon border down to areas southwest of Los Angeles. The Mendocino Complex fire is the biggest in the history of the state. Firefighters say they've never seen fire seasons like they're seeing now. Governor Jerry Brown says, get used to it. And as to the heat waves, fires, and droughts from Finland to Greece to Japan, well, get used to those too, scientists say. This hour, On Point, California's wild wildfire season and the lessons for all of us. You can join us on air and online. Are you there? What are you seeing? What do you think of this phenomena? For the rest of us, do we need to change where we live? How we live. Of course, you can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. Send in your comments, On Point Radio. Joining me first is Daniel Berlant. He's Assistant Deputy Director of CAL FIRE, the state's fire agency. He joins us from CAL FIRE headquarters in Sacramento, California. Daniel was on the show last October when these massive fires hit Napa and Sonoma and left 42 dead. Daniel, thanks for coming back on Point.
Yeah, good day to you.
And we're sorry that it has to be under these circumstances, another devastating season in California. We'll get to the bigger picture, but first, please update us, if you can, on this efforts to contain this monster, what's being called the Mendocino Complex Fire, the largest in state history.
Well, overnight, our crews were able to make good progress, especially on the southern edge of this fire. The Mendocino Complex is actually two very large fires that are burning very close to each other. They have not grown into one, but they are very close. One of the fires we saw no activity and no growth in yesterday, but one of them, the northern one, the Ranch Fire, this is near Clear Lake. This is about 100 miles north of San Francisco. That fire has continued to be very active. We still have about 14,000 people evacuated by this fire. And as you mentioned, combined, this Mendocino Complex has grown to over 300,000 acres, making it our largest wildfire in our state's history. And unfortunately, it seems like every single year we keep getting these fires that hit the record books.
Talk about how the firefighters are holding up. We're, you know, dangerous, difficult conditions, long hours. Do you have the resources you need to fight this beast?
You know, the last couple of months have been nonstop fire to fire to fire, and it really seems like it's been nonstop from last year. I mean, as you mentioned, you know, we spoke in October when we had fires devastating the North Bay, Santa Rosa communities, and then in December, more fires down in Southern California. We're working very hard to ensure that that our firefighters are getting some rest, getting some downtime before the next round of fires. We're very fortunate; 17 other states have sent us resources, even firefighters from as far as New Zealand, coming into California to provide us support. Another thing that's helped us this year is with this fire activity, Governor Brown actually increased our resources, giving us additional firefighters, additional fire equipment, and obviously we have needed them and will continue to need them going into the peak season, because here we are in August, and even though people typically think of the summer months as being traditional fire season months, it's typically actually the fall months, September, October. That's historically when we experience our largest and our most damaging fires. So unfortunately, the worst could potentially be yet to come.
An ominous warning. I helped cover the devastating Sonoma and Napa fires and the Santa Barbara fires last year. And, you know, firefighters and locals on the ground were telling me, you know, this is the worst we've seen. These fires are bigger and stronger. I mean, is it really even worse so far this fire season?
You know, that's been a saying that that I continue to hear from our veteran firefighters, almost every single year now. 5 years ago, when we had our state's most severe drought in recent times, we were starting to see these type of fire conditions, and our firefighters were seeing fires burn at such rapid rates that we had never seen before. But that's really become, and it's almost a cliche word here in California, but it's become the new norm to have these type of fires burning at this intensity, this severity, and earlier in the year. And it really is just a point of, result of our changing climate here in California. Our summers are longer. Our fire seasons have now become longer. And as a result, fire conditions become more intense and more severe.
Well, here was California Governor Jerry Brown at a recent press conference warning Californians that really they're going to have to get used to these record-breaking fire seasons.
We're in a new normal. We're in a drought that will continue, but I would suspect there'll be more fires to come, and more fires each year for a very long time.
Daniel Berlant from Cal Fire, talk about how the state is preparing for that if, you know, these super fire seasons aren't just every 2 or 3 years, they might be every year.
Well, we focus very hard on that, on preventing these fires, making sure that that we reduce the risk of new fires from starting. But really over the past decade, we've tried to change our paradigm to looking more ahead of time, preventing fires by adapting to them, making sure our homes are built with more fire ignition resistant building materials, ensuring we have defensible space, clearing dead vegetation around homes, all these steps helping to make sure that when these fires do occur, because they are going to occur, that we're increasing our chance of these homes and of our residents being able to be protected from these fires. So we really have to start working on being adapted to these type of fire conditions. And we're going to need more resources as we've continued to get to battle these fires as they grow into the future. But adapting our overall mindset that these fires are natural here in California and they are now a part of our everyday life, these severe ones, we have to adapt to that.
Daniel Berlant, I'm curious, given what's happening in California, do you think some Californians may have to rethink where they live, how they live, and move away from some of these areas that are high fire risk, given the realities of a warming climate and these super fire seasons?
One of our new programs that we launched about 5 years ago, it was what we call our land use planning program, where we actually go out and provide technical fire expertise to local building officials, local planners, so that as local governments are making land use decisions of where to put subdivisions, that we provide them a fire expert to make sure that where we're building is to the safest standards as possible, that they're using building materials that are going to resist embers raining down from them, that they ensure that exits and entrances are not just plenty to get people in and out, but also to get fire equipment in and out when a fire occurs. And so that's our biggest role here and our big focus the last several years is helping local governments make land use decisions so that as we do build more homes, because obviously our populations are growing, that we make sure that we're doing that in a wise manner.
We're talking about the record-breaking fire season out west. Daniel Berlant, Assistant Deputy Director of Cal Fire. He joined us from Cal Fire headquarters in Sacramento. Thank you so much, Daniel, for taking your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And joining me now from Sacramento is Ryan Lillis, a reporter for the Sacramento Bee. He's covered many of Northern California's fires for more than a decade. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're keeping an eye on all of these blazes, and you've been on the ground covering the Carr Fire near Redding in the north. Once again this year, some California communities have really been devastated. It had a huge impact. Talk about what you saw up at the Carr Fire in terms of human impact on how people live.
So I was at the River Fire, the Mendocino Complex, which was the one that Mr. Berlant was just talking about.
Oh, you were there on the ground then? Okay.
I was at that fire, yeah, correct. Okay. What you're seeing communities that are going through this now, year in and year out, in that Lake County area near Clear Lake, where the Mendocino Complex is burning, they're still having fundraisers for fires from 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. That same area in 2015, there was a huge fire called the Valley Fire that burned nearly 2,000 structures, killed a few people. There was another fire the year after that. And then here we are again in the summer of 2018, and as Mr. Berlant said, now, normally our fire season is September, October, that fall area. But here we are in the middle of summer, earlier than people plan or anticipate for. And you have entire communities evacuated. This fire has now destroyed more than 115 homes. To give you some perspective, it's mm-hmm. about twice the size of the city of Chicago, 9 times the size of San Francisco, about the same size as the city of Los Angeles. It's just enormous. It's filling all of Northern California with smoke. I'm here in Sacramento, more than 100 miles away, and we have smoke in the sky every day. And so this fire's impact is just huge. As is the Carr Fire, the Ferguson Fire near Yosemite, and we're just not quite ready this early in the season to be going through this already.
Yeah, Yosemite National Park, we should point out, is I understand it's still closed indefinitely from the massive fire there. And, you know, as Daniel Berlin with Cal Fire talked about being, you know, the cliche of the new normal, the fact is these devastating fire seasons, if it's year long, and as you point out, the big fire season really starts in September, October. The state adjusting to this, it's going to take money, resources, planning to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, you talked about changing where we live. You know, there are 40 million of us here in California. And one of the things that people love about living in California is that you can be so close to just incredible wilderness and natural resources. And more and more people are choosing to live in those areas. What's been a little bit different the last couple of years with the Carr Fire in Redding. Redding's a city of about 90,000 people. And then last year, the Tubbs Fire that was mentioned earlier, the fire in Santa Rosa. Those were fires that began in maybe the more rural, mountainous areas, but quickly went into cities. Not small towns, not hamlets, not, you know, sparsely populated areas, but cities, large cities, and destroyed, you know, hundreds of homes in places where I guarantee you people who lived in those cities thought that they were completely shielded from any kind of wildfire threat. They were probably aware of the fact that they were living near a wildfire zone, but what we certainly saw in Santa Rosa last year were suburban-style neighborhoods on flat land. That fire jumped across Highway 101 and destroyed an entire neighborhood. And so we're seeing these fires reach places that they hadn't reached before.
Ryan Lillis, reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Ryan, thanks for your insights and for taking the time.
Thanks, my pleasure.
You can join the conversation. Do states have to add the burden of climate change to their budgets alongside schools and roads? I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, Asma.
Hey, Scott.
Another crazy week. We've got North Korea.
Yep, we got Russia.
Midterms.
And, of course, President Trump. And what happens whenever there is crazy news that erupts? We pop into the studio and break it down to make sense.
So if you see a headline,
we've discussed it.
It's the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to On Point. I'm Eric Westervelt. We're looking at the new normal, or perhaps we should say the new abnormal, in California and beyond, as we're seeing extreme weather and wildfires burning, in some cases, out of control. You can join the conversation. What is going on here? Is there a better way for communities and governments to respond, to react, to plan? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining the conversation now from Ukiah, California, is Lainia Quinn Davidson. She's Area Fire Advisor with the University of California's Cooperative Extension, which works with counties and communities in the state on managing the threat of wildfires. She's also Northern California Coordinator of the California Fire Science Consortium. And Lainia, thanks for joining us. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me today. Happy to be here.
Appreciate it. Also with us from University Park, Pennsylvania, is Michael Mann, Professor of Atmospheric Science and the Director of the Earth Science System Center at the Pennsylvania State University. He's also co-author of the book, The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. It's just out in paperback. Michael Mann, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Eric. Good to be with you.
Lainia Quinn Davidson, I want to start with you. You work closely with communities in California. You're seeing this play out over a number of years. Are we reporters and hosts hyping this, or is it that bad out there?
Yeah, I definitely don't think the situation is being hyped up. I'm sitting here in Ukiah, and there's a thick blanket of smoke, and I think everyone can kind of feel that the tension around the ranch fire in the Mendocino complex. And this is really hits close to home for me. I'm from Trinity County, which is north of here, and my mom's house is only about 20 miles from the car fire. So the last month or so has just been really intense in Northern California, and you know, the loss of lives and the loss of homes, and we're not hyping this up. These are issues that are really present. They're becoming year-round concerns, and I think it's time for us to rally and work together to make some change.
So in the last 5 years, there have been sort of major fire events every year in California. That used to be every few years, correct?
Yeah, I think when I was growing up and over the last couple decades, we'd see a major fire every few years. We kind of had the big fire seasons that happened every 5 years or so. And in the last 5 to 10 years, every year has been a big season. And we've talked about it a little. Daniel and Ryan touched on, you know, the Valley Fire, the Rim Fire, the King Fire, the Thomas Fire, the Tubbs Fire. I think we're becoming really used to every year having some kind of major fire event in California. And, of course, they talked about the climate, and then there's the fuels issue and people moving into the wildland-urban interface, which is, you know, kind of mixing in the communities with the wildland areas, and all of those things coming together to create the situation that we have today.
Let's take some callers first. Robert is calling from Columbus, Georgia. Robert, welcome to the conversation on Point.
Hello, Eric. My comment is that it's nice that you're discussing this, but it's all the Band-Aid. It's not the cure. The only cure is people have to have the right perspective and attitude. The Earth is the same size now as it has been for trillions of years. The population of the Earth is over 7 billion. It's doubled since 1950. It's still increasing. The Earth cannot support that many people. Historically, there have never been this many people using the earth, using the energy.
Robert, you get us to the bigger picture of climate change, warming climate, and population growth. Thank you for your comment. Michael Mann, to you on this, are we with this fire season, are we moving clearly from, you know, prediction about warming to clear observation?
Yeah, I've said it before and I'll say it again. This is the face of climate change. The impacts of climate change are no longer subtle. We're seeing them play out in real time. We're seeing them play out on our television screens, in our newspaper headlines. And that's what we're talking about here. Climate change is getting real. We are seeing now how devastating the impacts of climate change already are.
We can't necessarily draw a clear line to every fire, but you are making the case that, look, this has changed the conditions. Talk about that in terms of climate change.
Sure. So it's not rocket science. You know, you make the planet warmer, you dry out the continents in subtropical regions, in places like California. You warm up the winters so there's less snowpack and less runoff in the spring, less water running off from the mountains. Those factors come together in a perfect storm. Those are the factors that give you unprecedented wildfires. And look, it's not a coincidence that California has had its two worst wildfires now within the last year, a time when we are seeing record drought, we're seeing record warmth, record low snowpack, and there's an added ingredient, which is changes in our weather patterns, changes in the jet stream that actually favor the sorts of weather regimes in California that create these conditions in the first place.
The warming climate is making these more extreme, more dangerous, and lasting longer.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess to you, Lainey Quinn-Davidson, you work with communities. Given what Michael Mann just said, I mean, are communities having to change strategies on how they deal and adapt to this new normal, as Governor Brown put it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things to think about is that fire is one of the only natural disasters, if you want to call it that, that we fight against. You know, we think of hurricanes and earthquakes and other natural disasters where we kind of try to adapt and identify vulnerabilities and change our behavior. And for the longest time, we haven't treated fire like that. We've treated it as something we can just put out and fight. And I think we're getting to the point, and communities are starting to understand that it's time to work with it and learn how to adapt and how to make change that makes us more resilient, so that we can learn to live with fire. So there are a lot of efforts nationwide, and communities are developing strategies to adapt to fire and live more closely with fire. And I think we're learning that this is not just an issue that's affecting homes that are in the forest or homes that are in these more wildland areas. As I think Daniel mentioned, you know, some of the areas that are burning in California are actually considered urban areas. So it's something that we all need to be thinking about, whether we live in a city where we don't feel that we're at risk or if we live out in a rural area.
That brings me to a comment on our Facebook page from Ezra Miller. What about bringing back controlled burning more so that flammable debris, you know, doesn't build up in the forest? Lainia, to you, more use of controlled burns, given the nearly 100 years of fire suppression, is certainly playing a role in building up these fuels in the nation's forests.
Absolutely. And this is something that I work on a lot. I think prescribed fire or controlled burning, the use of fire as a tool, is something that we're going to be looking to more and more. And we need to have all of those things in the toolbox, whether it's prescribed fire or mechanical thinning, grazing. There are a lot of strategies, and we need to have all of that in the toolbox. And prescribed fire in particular, I think, is going to be a very important tool for reducing fuels and restoring fire regimes and protecting the areas that we really want to keep. So, you know, a lot of forests in California are adapted and have evolved to have fire, and we've taken that out of those systems. And prescribed fire is going to be one of the key ways that we can bring that back in a really controlled and safe way.
And Michael Mann, I want to ask you, I mean, you've mentioned a little bit in writing, you talk about these feedback loops that are sort of uncertainties that we may not know about. Talk a little bit about that, the unintended or unknown sort of impact beyond fires.
Sure. Let me first say that there clearly is a need for adaptive measures, and there's no question that we do have to adapt to this changing environment. But if we don't act on the underlying problem that is aggravating these wildfires, which is human-caused climate change, then there is no new normal. I actually corrected my friend Jerry Brown the other day. I don't think that that's useful framing to call this a new normal, because it will continue to get worse if we don't act on the underlying problem, which is our burning of fossil fuels and the generation of carbon pollution in the atmosphere that's warming the planet. So we have to solve this problem at its root. Now, when it comes to uncertainty, as you've alluded to, yes, there's uncertainty in the science, but it is not our friend. As we have understood better the mechanisms involved in climate change over the years, we have found that things can happen even faster than we had predicted just years ago. And we're seeing that play out. And here's an example of a surprise. The sea ice in the Arctic is melting faster than we expected. It's on a trajectory where it may be gone at the end of the summer every year in a matter of a couple decades. And the climate models didn't predict that to happen until the end of the century. But as we understand the underlying mechanisms, we put them into the models, we find that actually can happen faster. And here's the thing. What happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. It's not like Las Vegas. What happens when you melt the Arctic sea ice and you warm up the Arctic, you change atmospheric temperature patterns in a way that alters the jet stream. And it alters the jet stream in a way that makes it more likely to have one of these ridges, one of these high-pressure centers over the west coast of the U.S. that generates this unprecedented heat and drought and wildfire. Now, we didn't understand those mechanisms just years ago. And as we learn more, we realize we face an even tougher problem here.
More surprises to come that we don't fully understand, and they won't be welcome. Jim is with us from the U.S. Virgin Islands. Jim, welcome to On Point and to the conversation.
Thank you, Eric. Interesting discussion. In the U.S. Virgin Islands, our zoning codes require us to have 10 gallons of storage, water storage, underneath our homes for every square foot of roof space to deal with our lack of public water supply, and we collect it from the rain. It seems like California and the zoning codes are doing nothing in regards to the structures themselves to require that water of some manner be held up high in the roof, maybe in the roof peak or a water tower, or underneath the house with some mechanism to pump the water up in the event of fire, understanding that public electricity will in all likelihood be out. And so you need to be self-maintained and be able to take care of yourself, be able to drip water all over your house when it happens and for a sufficient period of time to let the fire pass.
Interesting.
And do it by itself because you're defenseless otherwise. And I'm not an architect, but it doesn't seem like it's beyond rocket science to do this and to require it and to save many, many homes that would otherwise be gone. So that was my comment for you all today, is to be defensive and proactive.
Thanks to proactive, defensive, Jim. Thanks for your call. And Lainey Quinn Davidson, I mean, given the need to sort of have a year-round focus, Jim's point is well taken.
Yeah, I think that his point really speaks to the idea that we can do things at the home level to address some of our fire risk. And water, you know, water strategies could be one of those. But I think there are a lot of other things that we don't often think about that actually end up being the key reasons why homes burn. So, you know, how many people are out there checking their gutters and making sure that there aren't leaves stacking up in them? Thinking about the vents on their attics and also, you know, having a wooden deck with things piled under it. I think there are a lot of things right there at the home that we can do to really help decrease our own risk. So I definitely, when I work with landowners and homeowners, I encourage people to start looking at those things. And a lot of homes burn not from a flaming front coming through, but from embers landing, like I said, in the gutter or on the edge of the roof and catching on fire that way. So those are some really effective things we can do.
And Michael Mann, you quite rightly take issue with the phrase, you know, the new normal. Maybe we should call it the new worsening normal, or the it's going to get worse progressively unless we take action normal, something like that.
Yeah, well, no, that's right. And the good news here is we can take action. We're already taking action. And California, under Jerry Brown's leadership, really is taking a leadership position on climate change internationally, on the international stage. At a time when that leadership in the White House, we don't have that leadership in our current Republican Congress. Despite that, we are making progress. The United States is likely to meet its obligations under the Paris Accord. The Paris Accord doesn't solve this problem, but it gets us about halfway to the cuts that we need to make in our carbon emissions if we're going to avoid truly dangerous and catastrophic global climate changes. So there's some good news here. We're making progress, but we have to do more. And frankly, if we don't like the fact that there is no leadership at the national level in this country right now on climate change, in less than 100 days, we have an opportunity to send a signal to Washington, D.C. in these midterm elections.
Good point. President Trump and his administration, of course, to reiterate, have pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. Jim is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Eric. I read that the global warming causes the jet stream to stay stationary and allows these weather patterns to stay in one spot. What is it about global warming that keeps these keeps the jet stream stationary?
Great question. Michael Mann at Penn State, you want to handle that one?
Sure thing. Great question. So when you warm the Arctic more than the rest of the planet, which is what happens with human-caused climate change, because we're melting ice there, that means the Arctic Ocean can absorb more sunlight. It warms even faster than the rest of the planet. We call that a positive feedback. It might sound like a good thing. It's not. It's a vicious cycle. It causes that region to warm up even more. And here's the interesting thing. The jet stream in our atmosphere is actually driven by the contrast in temperature as you go from the equator to the pole. So as we warm the Arctic more, we're decreasing that contrast. That means we're decreasing the strength of the jet stream, and that means those weather systems indeed aren't being moved along as quickly as they used to. They're more likely to remain stationary. And here's the other ingredient. We increasingly think that climate change is actually leading to the jet stream becoming wavier, broader meanders, larger dips south and north. And that means that those ridges, those high-pressure centers, get even deeper. It intensifies these weather patterns, like the one that's leading to this unprecedented drought and heat and wildfire in California.
We got a comment from a website from a man named Creaker. People and infrastructure, we need to plan. We need to be planning more. Instead, we fight over whether climate change is actually happening. And he makes a valid point, as Michael Mann points out. Maybe this is the face of climate change. Hold on, there's lots more to talk about. We're talking about what scientists say is a new era of extreme weather here and around the globe. We'll talk about that right after the break. You can join the conversation. Listeners outside of the U.S., join us. Are you seeing record temperatures, droughts? Stateside listeners, can you afford the flood and fire insurance? Where are we headed? What are their issues? I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Did cutting taxes actually grow the economy?
And what makes DJ Khaled the king of pop music?
The Indicator, a daily podcast where we tackle the big economic questions.
You're listening to On Point. I'm Eric Westervelt. We're talking about record-breaking weather patterns here and around the globe as wildfires burn in California and big parts of the American West. You can join our conversation. Are we doing enough? Is there more planning to do? What more can we do? Are there new strategies to try? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Lainey Quinn Davidson, an area fire advisor with the University of California's Cooperative Extension, and Michael Mann, director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University and co-author of The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. And Michael Mann, I want to ask you, some impacts of climate change are clearly visible, like these fires. Others, less so. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's the veritable tip of the iceberg. When the impacts of climate change are becoming as profound, playing out in real time as they are now, you know that there's actually much more under the surface. And indeed, we are probably committed to at least another degree or so of warming, a degree Fahrenheit, about a half a degree Celsius of warming just from the greenhouse gases we've already put into the atmosphere as the Earth slowly equilibrates in response to that. So there's additional climate change that's in the pipeline, and we are going to need to adapt to those changes. But if we don't act on this problem to reduce our emissions dramatically, we will exceed our adaptive capacity. And so, as we've been talking about here, there are extreme weather events that are being made more frequent and more intense by climate change. And we're seeing that now in the form this summer of record droughts, record heat waves, record floods, and of course, the record wildfires. Superstorms like Maria, which devastated Puerto Rico last year, and Harvey, which was the worst flooding event on record, Hurricane Harvey, when it struck Houston.
Superstorm Sandy as well a few years ago.
Superstorm Sandy. You know, people sometimes ask me, you know, where's the tipping point going to happen in the public understanding of this problem? What's the galvanizing event? We've had them. What more do people need to see? The reason for inaction now isn't a lack of recognition of the damage that climate change is already doing. It's the fact that we have politicians who are too often unwilling to do what's right for their electorate and instead doing the bidding of special interests who fund their campaigns. We need to act on this problem now, or we will see far worse climate change impacts than the ones that are already so obvious. One last point here. The critics sometimes say, well, that will cost too much. It'll cost too much to act on climate change. If we need a reminder of what the cost of inaction on climate change is, it is before our eyes right now.
Valid points. Larry is calling from Maine. Larry, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Eric. I have a fairly easy solution for the forest fires. and that would be pumping stations approximately 60 to 100 miles along the coast, each pumping station pumping water from the ocean to approximately 100 miles in with various holding tanks. And the each town would be required to have a large truck that could get the water to put out the forest fires.
Hmm.
Now, before you poo-poo the saltwater idea, on the East Coast, I lived here all my life, and the amount of salt that the trucks, each township has its own truck. The trucks put out on the road is incredible. The amount of salt that would be required, would be put on the ground, putting out a forest fire, would not be a great deal.
Larry, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. Lanya Quinn Davidson, interesting idea from Larry. Use seawater to fight fire. Is this a Band-Aid on a problem or something people are looking into?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Larry's getting at here is kind of what I talked about early on in the show, which is that we have this attitude of continuing to fight fire. And I think it's time for us to get a little more, to dig a little deeper. And in a lot of areas, for instance, where the car fire happened, we had ample water. There's Whiskeytown Lake is right there. The fire actually burned all around it. Water was not the limiting factor, right? So I think on this show, we're getting at kind of the different scales of actions that we can take. And Michael's talking big picture, climate, you know, there are actions we can take at this kind of major scale that need to happen. And then I mentioned the scale of the homeowner and the actions that can happen there. And there's another scale, which is more of the community scale and that kind of in-between of thinking about fuels treatments and what we can do to buffer communities and what we can do on land use planning and, you know, coding and things like that, where we can develop strategies at the community level that are not just about fighting the fire and putting it out, but really about learning to live with it, because we know we're going to continue to have fire on the landscape in California and across the West. So,
Lena, speaking of those community efforts, at the mid-level efforts, so to speak, is California working with other states or communities outside of California, you know, to start to come up with strategies to mitigate some of these climate challenges and their impacts?
Yeah, that's a great point. There are actually some really innovative efforts that are happening nationwide that are trying to highlight examples from communities that are kind of getting it right and trying new things. There's a group called the Fire Adapted Communities Learning Network that is all about sharing strategies and connecting communities who are doing this kind of work.
Carol is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Carol, welcome to the program.
Hi, Eric.
What's your comment or question?
My comment is just that my son was a wildland firefighter a few years ago. He did it for about a year. And so I have the perspective of, you know, a parent of a wildland firefighter. You know, we worried incessantly during that time when he did it. Of course, we were proud of him. He talked to us about it, and one of his comments that I particularly remember is that when people didn't get out and they had to rescue them, they had to spend that time, you know, rescuing them instead of being out doing what they were supposed to do. He also made comments about how, you know, kind people were to help them, give them a place to sleep or give them stuff to eat. He loved it, but it was, I'm sure, the hardest job he's ever done.
Yeah.
He's an environmentalist now, so, you know, he's dealing with the things that you guys are talking about, and I'm so glad that you are, because it's so important. I mean, we need to do something about this. It's terrible, and I just wanted to give a shout-out to the firefighters.
Indeed. Thank you, Carol. I appreciate your call, and I've seen a lot of that out there as a reporter covering this. It takes tragedy sometimes to bring people together, and while you have a few criminals maybe trying to take advantage of it, going out looting, more and more I just saw people being kind to each other, giving each other food, water, helping firefighters, putting up homemade signs, thanking first responders, and looking out for each other, trying to help, you know, elderly, disabled folks that, you know, it's not as easy to jump in their car and run away and hopefully. And Lania, do you think the federal government, the federal role, you know, are they doing enough? Are they stepping up? Or given the administration right now in Washington in charge and power, is there some backsliding on that?
Well, I mean, I think one thing that's not really a partisan issue is just the idea that we need to do something and we need to be maybe more actively managing our landscape. So I think that's something that everyone can kind of agree on. Now, what that looks like is variable. And I think at the local level, federal land managers are really trying to do more. And in California, some of the federal land managers are the ones who are setting the example with prescribed fire and thinning projects. And, for example, Yosemite National Park has a really active program and does a lot of amazing work that we could all learn from. So I think there are different scales, even, you know, when we talk about the federal government. But I see our federal land managers as being leaders in some of these, you know, some of this fire related effort. So
we're talking fire, drought, climate change. Harvey is joining us from Maine. Harvey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Eric. I feel a little guilty about some of the fires out west because I was a firefighter back in the early 50s, putting out little fires up in the tall timber in Idaho and Montana. Hmm. But in fact, one fire chased us off the ridge twice in the same day. But anyway, the big point here, I agree with everything everybody said so far. I just want to emphasize one of the points that's already been raised. One of the biggest things we've got to do to clamp down on this and a bunch of other factors is to get rid of politicians who are both science deniers and climate change deniers. If the private industry should not be setting policy, scientists should be setting policy on things like this. And that's the biggest thing we've got to do come November and every other election from now on.
Harvey, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Michael Mann, I want to go to you to just take us out of the U.S. for a little bit, a little more global perspective. Talk about some of the extreme events we might be seeing, you know, around other parts of the world in the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah, and that's what makes this summer so significant. That's why I've said that we are seeing the face of climate change, because it's not just isolated extreme weather events, the wildfires in California, the floods in Japan, the heat waves around the Northern Hemisphere. There's a coherence to these extreme weather patterns this summer, unlike anything we've seen before. We're literally seeing unprecedented extreme weather events around the entire Northern Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And it does relate to the way that we're fundamentally changing the very fabric of the atmosphere by warming the planet, warming the Arctic in particular, as we said earlier, changing the jet stream in a way that it causes it to be more wiggly and to get stuck in place. And the same locations get rained on day after day after day, and that's when you get unprecedented flooding, or baked by the sun day after day after day. And that's what we've seen in California. That's what we've seen in parts of Europe and the Middle East. So this may be the summer where human-caused climate change showed its hand. We've seen the enemy, and it is human-caused climate change. Let me make one last comment here, because Lania made a really important point, which is there's sort of a hierarchy of ways that we can act on this problem. And there's a lot that we can do at the personal level, individual actions, changing our lifestyles in ways that make us healthier and save us money and often reduce our carbon emissions. And we should do all those things. As our former presidential science advisor, a good friend of mine, John Holdren, said some years ago, how we respond to these problems is going to be a combination of three things: adaptation, adapting to those changes we can no longer prevent; mitigation, preventing those changes we still can; and finally, suffering. And I think we all can agree we want to minimize that third option. And that means the other two options, we've really got to put them on the table and act now.
Scott from Island Point, Vermont, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Yes, I was just wondering, isn't it kind of a fact that we're past the tipping point at this place and time? I mean, since the polar cap has melted, what, 5 or 6 years back, and the conditions of the ocean,
recently received a letter from Ocean Conservancy that said 45% of all ocean life has disappeared in the last 50 years. Mm. I was just wondering what your comments were on that.
Well, I'd like to go to Lainey on that. I mean, we have to do more than just scare people and have doom and gloom. Respond a little bit to the caller there.
Yeah, Eric, I think you make a good point. And I liked a lot what Michael just said about adaptation, mitigation, and suffering. I think a big part of the work that I do is trying to help people feel like they have some way to engage and some place in all of this, and that they're not powerless, because I don't think it helps any of us to think that we're beyond some tipping point and we should just throw in the towel. I think we need to be feeling empowered somewhat to make the changes that we can make, and whether that is at the personal scale or at that kind of mid-grade community scale, or whether it's taking political action to make larger change. I think it's really important for those of us who work with the public and who work with landowners and land managers and then work with politicians at the higher level to be sending a message that it's not all over and that we do have some place here that we can make a difference. Mm. And I still really believe that.
Michael Mann, to you, I guess I'm curious, given that it is election season and there'll be midterms in the fall, and as you say, this is the face of climate change, this is real, are you seeing and hearing enough discussion out there beyond some media programs like ours saying, talking about this, making it an issue, making it a priority, bringing it to the fore?
Yeah, well, I was on NBC Evening News last night talking about this problem. So I think we've sort of we may have breached a different tipping point. This is a battle of two different tipping points. The tipping point where we commit to truly dangerous and catastrophic climate change. And there's no one fixed amount of warming that's going to cause that. The farther we go down this road, the worse it gets. But then there is, by contrast, the tipping point in the public consciousness, a tipping point in how we think about this problem, our willingness to embrace and act on climate change. And I think we're very close to that tipping point. Mm. I think this summer really has made a difference in terms of the public awareness of how profound the threat of climate change already is. And I like to think that when voters go to the voting booths in less than 100 days, they're going to be thinking about climate change and the need to act on this problem. And I think we will see progress.
Adaptation, mitigation, and suffering. Hopefully the last one we will have less of. Lainey Quinn-Davidson, Area Fire Advisor with the University of California's Cooperative Extension. Lainey, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Mann, who's director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University and co-author of The Madhouse Effect. Michael, thank you as well for your insights and for coming on Point.
Thanks, Eric. It was a pleasure.
Well, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, PepsiCo CEO Indra Nooyi is stepping down. With a number of female CEOs dropping, we will take a hard look at the glass ceiling to the C-suite. That's coming up. I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point.